You're listening to audio from Ascend Church. For more information about Ascend or to access more gospel-centered tools to grow as a disciple of Christ, visit ascendkc.org.
Well, let's grab our Bibles and turn to Mark chapter 3. If you don't have a Bible, reach in the seat backs in front of you. I like that, what Tim said. And Tim, thank you for hosting us this morning. It just is an opportunity to move us from the busyness of even a Sunday morning as we sprung forward with our watches to be able to be recalibrated on why we are here. And when he said that, it reminded me of my mom. My mom's a flight attendant, and so she talks about all of the training that they go through as flight attendants and, you know, pointing to the exit rows and all of that. And you know, God bless them. They are those people that maybe sometimes, like pastors, they say things, but people don't listen. But hopefully, as we approach the study of God's Word, we won't treat this like a flight attendant. Hopefully, you will see that in these words, you find the words of eternal life, because they point us to Christ. Let me read our passage together, Mark chapter 3, and those Bibles that you grabbed in front of you in the seat backs can be found 8:38, the chapter 3 of Gospel of Mark that we will be going through. And so let me read Mark chapter 3, beginning in verse 13. And he, Jesus, went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. He appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Then he went home. And the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he is out of his mind. We'll skip down to verse 31. I'll explain why we do this later on in the sermon. Verse 31, and his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, your mother and your brothers are outside. They're seeking you. And he answered them, who are my brother, my mother, and my brothers? And looking about those who sat around him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. You know, I love my family. I love my last name. I love Terrell. I don't know. It's just maybe the history of the Terrell family. Maybe it's the experience that I had growing up. I love my dad, my mom, I love my brother, I love my sister, I love my grandparents. I love seeing the name Terrell even on athletes like Terrell Owens and Terrell Davis, which, by the way, he doesn't pronounce that right. I love Terrell. I remember when I was growing up, when the first times I realized that not everybody who has the name Terrell spelled correctly and pronounced correctly is related to me. In fact, I had people growing up asking me, there's this other Terrell in the major leagues, and we'll put a picture up of a couple baseball cards. You've got Jerry Terrell over here on our left. That is my dad. Man, he looks young, doesn't he? Maybe you can see a resemblance, the seriousness. Maybe that's what you see. But then there's this other guy, Walt Terrell. Walt was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers and some other teams, and people would ask me, wait a minute, I have this baseball card, it's spelled exactly the same, it's actually spelled the same, and he's in the major leagues, this guy has to be related to you. And I would ask my dad, and he would say, no, we are of no relation. What makes Walt Terrell not a member of the Terrell family, but Jerry Terrell is? Well, yes, there's last name. Yes, there's pronunciation. Yes, there's history and there's context. But there's also a family tree, isn't there? I love going up to Elysian, Minnesota. If you never heard of Elysian, Minnesota, you probably have no idea where it is. It's in Minnesota. It's just outside of Mankato. It's a very small town. It was about, I think, 300 people when my dad was growing up. But in Elysian, there's this cemetery right outside, and there are several headstones with the name Terrell. And it's been fascinating to me to walk through that cemetery with my grandparents explaining who Samuel C. Terrell was and who Samuel A. Terrell was and which one of them fought in World War I and assaulted the towers of the Germans and the machine guns and actually helped win a great battle just outside of Paris. And I love hearing those stories and hearing about their personalities, some good things, some not so good things, and seeing, man, that's probably why I'm influenced to act a certain way. I love my family, and family is important, isn't it? But there's a family that is even greater than our blood family. But there's two issues that are around this type of family. Number one is there are many people who claim to be part of this family who in fact are not. The second issue with this particular family is that there are people who are members of this family, but they do not act as family members should. And so we're given an opportunity through the vista that Mark provides of Jesus this morning to be able to see the family of Jesus, the true family. And as we do, look at the big idea in your notes. The true family of Christ is uniquely identifiable. Just as the Jerry Terrell family is identifiable as compared to the Walt Terrell family, so is the true family of Christ, and that's what we will see. And beloved, listen, this is an opportunity for you to evaluate, are you a member of the true family? Now, this passage is going to more specifically be talking about the call of the disciples, the 12. It's going to more specifically be talking about the family of Jesus, the blood relatives. But what it does through principle is put on display the family of Christ that is unpacked in the rest of the New Testament. So let's look, number one, at the true family. It's identifiably called. Would you write that down? The true family of Christ is identifiably called. Look at verse 13. It says, when Jesus went up on the mountain. I'll stop right here and just remind you that this is intentional. Jesus, from time to time, would get away from the hustle and bustle of life. Back in chapter 1, verse 35, he did that. In chapter 2, just before he met Levi, he went with his disciples in verse 13 and walked along the sea, getting away from the crowds. We've seen this already in chapter 3 as we arrived at verse 7, that Jesus went away. Beloved, again, I think it's important for me, because I don't think many of us do this, that it is important for us in our lives on a regular rhythm to get away. In fact, let me put a quote up on the screen. This is from Kent Hughes' commentary on the Gospel of Mark. He says, anything else will be accepted as a better excuse if one sets aside time for a business appointment, a trip to the hairdresser, a social engagement, or a shopping expedition. That time is accepted as inviolable. But if one says, I cannot come because that is my hour to be alone, one is considered rude, egotistical, or strange. What a commentary on our civilization when one has to apologize for it, make excuses, or hide the fact that one practices it like a secret vice, end quote. And this is true, isn't it? If you fill your day with busy activities from one business meeting to the next, to grocery shopping, to other shopping, to going to a sporting event for your kids, and day, moment after moment is accounted for by some activity, that is acceptable. But when we set aside an hour to just be alone, as the quote says, that is looked at as rude or odd in our society. But here's what I would like to say, because I think the Gospel of Luke actually helps us. The same parallel in Luke, Luke chapter 6, says that Jesus went to the mountain to pray. When I was at the Sea of Galilee, in a trip back in 2017, I took this picture that we'll put up on the screen. This is me looking out over the Sea of Galilee from the west. You can see my Crocs down there. Those are not official Israeli Crocs. But I got up at about 4 o'clock, which for a Terrell, that is ridiculous. Terrells by nature love to sleep in. But I got up at 4 o'clock because that view, and the picture doesn't even capture it, is unparalleled. I've never seen a view like that, as over the mountains to the east of the Sea of Galilee. And there's one particular mountain that I think where Jesus went that I called my mountain. And I think Jesus got away to a scene like this to be out in nature, to reflect on his own creation. But Luke tells us to also pray. And listen, beloved, I think what has happened in our society is we have begun to set aside times for ourselves, but more often than not, that time for ourselves is not profitable. And so we end up developing these rhythms of man caves or personal me time, and we string them together. But when we look at the substance of what we've actually done in that time, it hasn't actually refreshed us. And I think Jesus' model is a great model for us, that time away can be time of just taking trails. It can be time of, dare I say, playing video games. It can be time where we just get away and we veg. But listen, if the whole of our time of getting away is simply wasting time, then we're missing the example that Jesus provides. And so when he got away and he got to the mountain and he prayed, he called to himself some individuals. The word call means to summons. And it's not just a general call. There is an important reality when it comes to call, to evaluate the source of the call, the expectations of the call, and the enabling of the call. I'm going out into a subject that I don't know very well, but I looked at duck calls when I prepared this message. And duck calls in America go back to the end of the 1600s. I thought that was interesting. Most of the people that would do it would go or something like that. That's a horrible one. But in the 1800s, people started realizing, hey, wait a minute, I can actually make a device that will do what my hands can't do effectively. And most of us know about duck calls through Phil Robertson and the Duck Dynasty, where they've made an empire through duck calls. But duck calls serve a purpose. They're intended to sound like a duck, but there's a purpose to them that is not advantageous for ducks. And beloved, I think there are a lot of calls in our lives. Calls that are trying to sound like the call of God, to say, come to me, you'll experience satisfaction if you do. Come to me, I will give you the identity that will solve everything. We pursue business pursuits as though this is the end all be all. If I can just have this. How many times, beloved, have you said in your life, if I could just have this, my life would change? Duck call. Beloved, the identifiable call for the family of Christ is a very intentional, specific call. And we see that right here in the text. Look at what it says. It says in verse 13, he called to himself. Beloved, this is an important reminder that the call to the true family of Christ is not a call ultimately from a pastor. It's not a call from Christian authors. It's not a call from a church leader that the world recognizes as the leader of a church. It is the call from Christ himself. Write down John 15, 16. Jesus told the disciples that you did not choose me, I chose you. Beloved, the call that we're talking about is a call that originates from Jesus. In fact, you can write down Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, it says we look to Jesus, I think it's verse 3, the author of our faith. Beloved, the call of the disciples, specifically in this context, was from Jesus. And that was very different than the rabbis of Jesus' day. The rabbis would put their booths out there and say, hey, come to my school. And the students would look and say, okay, I want to go to Harvard. But Jesus doesn't do that. He says, no, I select the students. Beloved, that's important for us to remember, because I think sometimes we enter the family of God thinking too highly of ourselves. You know, the doctrine of God's sovereign selection is a doctrine that produces humility if you understand it correctly. There are some that respond to the doctrine of divine selection or election or predestination. They become prideful by it. But when we look at God's selection, especially when we look at this hodgepodge of people that he selected, it is very humbling. But the call that we're talking about to the family of Christ originates with the source of Jesus. But then there's also an expectation. Look at what it says in verse 13. He called them to himself. The call of Jesus is not to an organization or to a religion. It's to relationship with himself. But then there's also expectation, isn't there? He expects us to come to him. Beloved, that's the beauty of the gospel of Jesus Christ, is that it's not just some generic factual call that is out there. You look, even the demons believe the facts. In fact, James 2:19 says just that. Even the demons believe, and they actually respond with trembling, but they do not respond to become members of the true family. The expectation of the call to true family is that you come in devotion, that you abandon all of your perceptions, all of your definitions, all of your own pursuits. You abandon those and you pick up Christ. Christ becomes your lenses. You see the world and your experiences and your identity and your other family members through the lens of the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is the call. And the call equips and empowers. It's interesting, in verse 14, we'll see that these were also called apostles, the send out ones. Listen, beloved, none of us can respond to the call on our own. In fact, let me give you three responses to this that I hope will equip us biblically. Number one, this call is crucial because none of us would choose God on our own. You may say, well, Pastor, prove that from Scripture. Well, I would love to. John 1:13. It is not of the human will by which we enter into relationship with God. It is not us on our own that can somehow get to a point where we're like, okay, I guess it makes sense. I choose Christ. It's not possible. Write down Romans chapter 3 and verse 11. There is no one who seeks after God on their own. No one who understands. Ephesians 2, 1 through 3, we were dead in our trespasses and sins. That metaphor is intentional. There is no dead corpse that can do anything of life. We were dead in our trespasses and sins, pursuing our own desires, pursuing our passions, following after the world system, willfully so, enemies, Romans 5 tells us, of Christ himself. We would not choose Christ. So his call is crucially important. Number two, it's a specific calling. It's a specific calling that requires our repentance, that requires our turning from our sin, turning from our desires, turning from our definitions to Christ. We surrender our lives to Christ. We view him as the king of our lives, as the Lord of our lives. We are all in. We are committed. Now, we spend the rest of our lives growing in what that actually looks like and understanding it, but conversion is all in, loyalty to Christ. Number three, the calling empowers us. John 6:37, no one comes to the Father. No one comes to Christ unless the Father draws him. Why is this important? This is not just a theological lesson. What it does is it educates us on who God is. This is the God that we say that we worship. This is the God who we say we're in relationship with. This is what his expectations are of us. And we see these principles play out as we see Jesus calling to himself those whom he willed, those whom he desired. And it was 12, not the entire crowd. It was 12. The family is identified by a specific calling, the author, the expectations, and the empowerment coming from Christ and Christ alone. Number two, the true family of Christ is identifiably committed. It's identifiably committed. There's a little biblical theology here in verse 14. Jesus appointed how many? What does it say in the text? 12. That was a pregnant pause. In small group, you have to be okay as a leader with a pregnant pause. It's participation. Why is 12 important? Do you remember another time when 12 was important in the Old Testament? The tribes of Israel. See, what I think Mark is doing here is he's giving this imagery, and what Jesus did in selecting 12 is he's showing the progression of God's plan for his people. There are some people who try to segregate the people of God, and they'll say, well, there were the God-fearers before Israel, and then there were the tribes of Israel, and then there's the church age. But what I think Jesus is showing and what Mark is showing through the selection of 12 disciples is that God's plan had always been for a subset of humanity to be his people. And before Abraham, they were identified by a faith. They were identified as you get to the end of Genesis 4. In those days, people began to look to God. And then with Abraham, they began to be identified as people that having a faith in a promise. And then through Moses, following after laws and requirements that would identify them as the people of God. And then you get to the New Testament and you see the church age, and they're identified by a faith that they place on Christ. But I think what Mark and Jesus are showing here by selecting 12 disciples is saying this is the restoration of the Israel that rejected him. The people of God that rejected Christ, that failed with the Moses, with the law of Moses, this is the restoration of it, and it's actually the culmination of God's plan for his people. That's why when you get to Revelation, you see that there are 12 pillars in the foundation that represent the 12 tribes and 12 pillars that represent the 12 apostles. It's bringing everything together to say the people of God extend beyond ethnicities, beyond eras, and they are identified by their faith looking forward to Christ and looking back to Christ and in Christ during Jesus' ministry. So he selected 12, whom he also named apostles, so that, here's the henna clause, the purpose clause, they might be with him and he might send them out to preach. Now, just think about the disciples as they're listening to Jesus' commissioning. Y'all are going to be going out to preach. It's the same Greek term that describes what Jesus has been doing. And do you remember how people responded to Jesus in the synagogue? They were amazed at his preaching. And now the disciples were going to get to do this. But then what does it say in verse 15? What does it say? I'm not going to ask you to respond. That didn't go over very well. Verse 15, it says they would have authority to cast out demons. Remember, the people were astonished by this. This is what drew the crowds. So imagine the disciples as they're getting commissioned to do the very things that Jesus, the leader of the movement, was doing. Sign me up for that, right? It reminds me of a story that I heard of some New Yorkers. These New Yorkers were city slickers. This was back in like the late 1800s, and these city slickers decided they had had enough of New York City. So they decided to move to Texas to buy some land to farm, just like their ancestors did. And so when they arrived at their land, they purchased their land, and they realized very quickly they needed a mule. And so they went to a local ranchman, and they asked him, hey, do you have a mule for sale? And the ranchman said, sadly, no. And as he watched these New Yorkers, he realized, wait a minute, these are city slickers. And they said, hey, what are those balls that you have stacked behind you? Well, they were honeydews. And he decided, I'm going to have some fun with these city slickers. And he said, those are mule eggs. And all you have to do is y'all take them home, wait a few days, it'll hatch and you'll have your mule. Well, the city slickers were excited, and they got their mule egg, and they put it in the wagon, and they were headed back to their land, and as they were going, they hit a big bump. And that poor mule egg, boom, 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 split open. Well, by the time the New Yorkers realized this, they raced back to go find their mule egg, and a Texas rabbit had hopped up. And they saw this long-eared creature, and they're thinking, our mule egg has hatched. Only problem was that jackrabbit startled and went bounding off. And so those New Yorkers just chased after it. They went this way, they went that, they went uphills, they went downhills. And finally, they fell to a heap exhausted. One of them said, well, we lost our mule. The other one said, yes, but I'm not sure I'm interested in plowing that fast. Okay, some of you got it. Well, they knew they wanted to plow. They knew they needed a mule, but their perception of what was expected was too much for them. And I think the disciples would have been excited, like so many people are excited when they hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. You mean I could go to heaven? You mean I could have my sins forgiven? But just think through the historical context of what Jesus was calling them to. It says that they may be with him. Do you remember what happened to the hymn? Look back at chapter 3, verse 6. After Jesus had healed the man with a withered hand, verse 6 says, the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against Jesus, how to destroy him. So to be with him, to be associated with him, meant that the religious elite, the political elite, were assembling themselves against Jesus and against his followers. That's interesting. In fact, write down Psalm chapter 2, Psalm 2. And look at the vocabulary in Psalm 2 and how it says the counsel of people are against the Lord and his anointed. See if there's parallels there. That's interesting. But to be associated with Jesus was potentially a threat. Yes, you could preach, but then think about preaching. What was the content of Jesus' message? Look back at chapter 1 and verse 15. It was not just the time was fulfilled and the kingdom of heaven was at hand. That's a very positive message, but it was also repent. It was also you're a sinner. You are destined for judgment. You need to turn from your sin. You need to commit all in to Jesus. Well, that's not always an easily accepted preach message. And then there's the authority to cast out demons, and that sounds great, but think about the crowds that assembled as a result of that. Listen, crowds are not all they're cracked up to be. I remember when I was playing baseball, it was always a dream to play in front of thousands of people. When you're playing in high school, I mean, if you get 10 parents that come out, that's pretty cool. And I remember it a couple times that I got a chance to play in front of thousands in college and then thousands in pro ball, and that kind of changes things. And when you boot a ball, which I did many times, that's why I'm a pastor now, and all of a sudden you made a mistake, man, especially if you're playing on the road, those thousands of people, they let you hear about it. Crowds and popularity and momentum isn't always it's cracked up to be. And so the disciples were confronted with this reality and the commitment that is required in being a true family member of Jesus. Beloved, I want you to consider that. Have you counted the costs? Some of you might be sitting here and you responded to some positive, encouraging message of the gospel that left it at that, that somehow you could spend eternity in heaven, Jesus would meet your needs, that if you hook your wagon up to Jesus, you will be healthy, wealthy, and wise, and that's what you signed up for. But now you're hearing, wait a minute, no, it's more than that. It's different than that. It's actually surrendering everything that you are and picking up the cross of Christ, and you're realizing, oh, that's not what I signed up for. Well, now's your opportunity. Because just as Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, it may not sound on the surface that that is true satisfaction and that is true joy, but the end of the matter is this, chapter 12, verse 13. Worship God and obey him. That is where true satisfaction is found. It is a commitment, beloved, that is not all roses. Do you know that God will discipline you? Hebrews 12 says. He disciplines those whom he loved. There are times in our lives when we experience the discipline of God, and we might be like my father-in-law I love it. He said he gets cut off sometimes on the highway, and he says, don't they know who I am? I think sometimes as Christians, we suffer, or we get persecuted, or we get disciplined, and we think, don't people know who I am? Doesn't God know who I am? But the commitment that Jesus calls us to is illustrated by the apostleship, by the sending out, the expectations of Jesus for his disciples. The true family of God is identifiable by a resolve of commitment. Number three, the true family of Christ is identifiably complex. It's identifiably complex. If you want to dig into the 12 disciples, I cannot commend enough a book by John MacArthur called 12 Ordinary Men. And I would love to dig into them more, but I don't think the context allows for it. But it's a fascinating study of who it was that Jesus selected to be his 12 and to be the foundation for Christ's church. But it's a really complex family. We see that in verse 16, he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, which, by the way, that phrase there has some biblical theology to it. Remember, biblical theology reminds us that a phrase or a verse or a paragraph sits in the middle of a big story. And so while we appreciate the scene and the verse and the words and we appreciate their context, we also have to examine them in light of the whole story. So when it says that Jesus gave a name to Peter, we're reminded of Genesis 17, aren't we? When God gave a name to Abram of Abraham. We're reminded of Exodus, I think it was chapter 32, when God gave a name to Jacob of Israel. In fact, as we sang that song, O God of Jacob, the point of that phrase is to differentiate that God from all the other gods of the ancient world. So when Moses went before Pharaoh and said, Yahweh demands that his people are released, Pharaoh looked at his Rolodex of gods in Egypt and he's like, who is this Yahweh character? And so the Jews would identify their Yahweh as different from all the other gods by saying the God of Jacob, the God of Israel. And then you can also fast forward to Revelation 3 and Revelation 22, where a new name is given to church, a church in Revelation 3, and that in Revelation 22, we will be given a new name by which we are known. This one stuck with Peter. Matthew explains a little bit more the significance in Matthew 16. Mark doesn't, so we move on. It says, also there were James and John. We were introduced to them back in chapter 1. He gave to them the name, I'm not going to pronounce it again, but it's translated sons of thunder. And we don't know why he gave them this. We can see by their personality that they responded with great passion, with great aggression. So maybe that's why he gave them that. It's not recorded elsewhere in the apostles' epistles, so we don't know. Then there was Andrew, a fisherman, Philip, Bartholomew, who's also named Nathanael. Matthew, by most accounts, we know him to be Levi, that we were introduced to back in chapter 2, who was a tax collector. Thomas, John 20, tells us that he was the one who doubted. He was also a twin. James, the son of Alphaeus, he's either the brother of Matthew, who was also in chapter 2 told to be the son of Alphaeus, or just another father by that name, Thaddeus. And then it says Simon the Zealot. This is an interesting description. Most people think that the zealot term was that he was a political or a national zealot. He had great zeal for the political freedom of Israel, and that could be the case, but that term didn't actually come around until just before AD 70, which Mark was likely written around that time frame, so we don't know. Most likely he was known as the zealot in the time of Jesus because of his religious zeal. In fact, Jesus will say the mention of David's zeal for the house of God is what Jesus is following when he cast out the money changers, and he was zealous for the law and zealous for the will of the Father. So regardless, what it says is that Simon was over the top in his passions. And then it says, verse 19, there was Judas Iscariot, who, again, this is full-bloom aspect, informing this section here that he would betray him. This is a complicated group. And I know family can get complicated. Maybe you have a brother or sister that you're like, where did they come from? You know, everybody loves color, but they're emo. Is that what it is? Wearing all black? Okay, thank you. Trying to be relevant. I don't have that, so I really can't draw from a family illustration to illustrate this, but I can draw from baseball. My baseball teams, man, every team that I was on, there were guys that, man, we were buds. And then there were guys that were like, oh. I remember going into my junior summer season. I had just been playing for a tournament team as a sophomore, but that team disbanded. And all the Legion teams in our area, in my hometown, were all taken up. All the rosters were filled. And so we found in the newspaper that Oak Grove Truck Stop, post 379, had some openings. So my mom and I drove out to Oak Grove, Missouri. Went to the bingo hall. Saw a man walk up with, and I know I might offend some of you right here, I love this man. He's passed away. He was one of my greatest mentors. But he had this camouflage overalls. He had his spit cup. And he's talking about mushroom hunting. Now, I'm going to betray my city slicker reality here, but why do you have to wear camo for mushrooms? I mean, is the mushrooms like, oh, there's one. They're not going anywhere. I digress. I walk into this bingo hall. There's like fog of cigarette smoke. And then they tell me that I'm going to have to raise money by selling tickets to a hog roast at the bingo hall. My mom and I walked out of there and we said, where are we? I have to tell you, that first year was rough. Most of the kids' parents were either farmers or rural teachers talking about things like tractors and hay bales and how fun that is. I can relate to that. Most of the guys that I played with were wrestlers or football players, couldn't relate to that, and that first year was very, very rough. But even more complex than Oak Grove Truck Stop, post 379, was this group. I mean, you had fishermen who were blue collar. You had an accountant, as you'll see in John 6. You had a zealot, somebody who was zealous for religion or national patriotic pride, along with a sellout Jew, the tax collector. This is a complex group of people. How can you come together and actually be family? Well, a little window into that was Oak Grove Truck Stop. We banded together and did pretty well, winning state in 1993. Against all those big Legion teams. Because we had one principle that drove us, and that was winning. You know, beloved, I will hear people in our church that will say, hey, I'll get involved in small group, but I want to be with people who are my same age. I want to be with people whom I like. I like their personalities. We get along. These are people I would choose to be with. But the family of Christ doesn't play out that way. In fact, there's oftentimes people that I'm called to love and disciple and them to disciple me that I wouldn't personally choose. The family of Christ is complex. And they're identifiably complex. Not just by our physical features, but by our personalities, by our walk with Christ, by so many attributes. So how can a complex group of 12 come together and turn the world upside down? How can a complex group of baseball players win state? How can a complex group in this room come together and be a family that turns the attention of the outside world saying, I want that? Well, it brings us to number four. True family is identifiably consistent. It's identifiably consistent. Look at verse 20. Then Jesus went home, and the crowd gathered again. Now, this is not the masses we'll see down in verse 31. These are his followers. If you go back to chapter 2 and verse 15, you see that Jesus went to Matthew's house or Levi's house. There were many tax collectors and sinners, and it says there were many who followed him. So this crowd that is assembling at the house, most likely Simon's house, are those who would say, we are followers of Jesus. We are dedicated to him. And so they're assembling together. But look at what happens with the crowd. It's so massive. It's so wanting his attention that he and his disciples could not even eat. And that's significant. Eating in Israel was really important. And it wasn't just that they were foodies. It was for survival. It's that the time of eating and hospitality was extremely important, and yet there was so much crowd, so much ministry taking place, that Jesus and his disciples couldn't actually eat. They just couldn't. And so word travels pretty quick in the ancient world. Verse 21 says his family heard it. Now we'll see in verses 31 through 35, this is his blood family back in Nazareth, and they're hearing, hey, do you know what's happening with Jesus? Jesus is this crowd is massive. There are people coming from all the way down in Idumea. Remember that? That is 120 miles away from Capernaum. There are people traveling all from over Israel to come see your son. And in fact, it is so crazy, and he is so busy, the man isn't even able to eat. And the family says, that's it, we're stepping in. And their motivation for it, in verse 21, is that he's out of his mind. Now, the verb that Mark uses here is an interesting one in verse 21. It says, they went out to seize him. It's the word arrest. They went to control him. They went to adjust his agenda to be theirs, because in their mind, his agenda was crazy. Now, we're going to jump down to verse 31 because of a device that Mark uses called sandwiching. I haven't mentioned this before because this is the first instance, but we'll see it a lot more. What sandwiching is exactly what it sounds like. There's the bread, which is one event, but then the sandwich meat is a different, separate event, but it's related. And so we're going to jump down to verse 31 because it's the continuation of the top bread and the story that is in verses 21. And we'll come back to the sandwich meat because there is a lot of meat in these verses the next time. So jump down to verse 31. His mother and his brothers came, so they had made their way from Nazareth to Capernaum, and they were standing outside. They sent to him. That's interesting. It tells us how massive the crowd inside the house in the courtyard was. It says that they were circled around Jesus. It was such a large group that even his family members could not get inside. So they stand outside and they send for him. And the message that they send, kind of like, remember the telephone deal that you did when you were growing up? You had a big circle and one person would tell the story and then it would go around. Well, by the time it gets to Jesus, it's actually the story. It's actually the message that the family was sending, and that is, you need to come home. Now, it's not just sinful motivation that the family was demonstrating here, although I would submit to you that I believe the family was rejecting the mission of Jesus. They were rejecting the agenda of Jesus, and they were saying, no, the family agenda is more important than your mission and your agenda, and it's time that you submit yourself to us. Now, one of the things that I think is very revealing is it mentions the mother and it mentions the brothers, and some translations mention the sisters, but is there any mention of Joseph? There's a couple of reasons likely for that. Either number one, Jesus and Mark wants to make sure that we as Christians and our family only has one father. It could be that. But most likely it's that Joseph has died already. Do you remember who the oldest in the family was? It was Jesus. When you look at the Old Testament, when you look at the Jewish culture, the oldest had the responsibility to take care of the family. And so maybe what was happening is the brothers and sisters and Mary were looking around and saying, okay, enough's enough, Jesus. We have needs back here. Come home. But Jesus responds in such a way that in that day would have been startling. In our day, it just sounds straight out rude. Verse 33, Jesus answered them, who are my mother and my brothers? And you can imagine the class clown was probably like, well, the people outside. But Jesus says, here, and he gestured, that's what the verb communicates, here are my mother and brothers. But he differentiates it by a consistency. It's not just the fact that they were present. It's not just the fact that they identified by their words with Jesus. There is something that specifically identifies them as his true family, and that's found in verse 35, 4, explanation, whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. What is Jesus saying here? Well, let's first establish what Jesus is not saying. What Jesus is not saying is that physical family is unimportant. Would you please write that down? Because I don't want emails saying, huh, so you're saying I shouldn't care for my family. No, in fact, Jesus tells us otherwise. John 19:25-27, Jesus is hanging on the cross, getting ready to take his last breath, and he's thinking of his family, isn't he? And he says to John the Apostle, look to your side, and Mary, my mother, is now your mother. Mary, look to your side and see John, he is now your son. Take care of each other. Jesus considered family important. So does the rest of the New Testament. Ephesians 6, verse 1, 1 Timothy chapter 5. Whoever doesn't care for his family is worse than an infidel. So Jesus is not saying that family is not important, but here is what he is saying. Is he saying, warning, Christians can often put their family ahead of the gospel. Christians can often make decisions first and foremost, what is best for my family before what will most glorify God. In fact, let me give you two ways you can tell whether or not you as a family of God are out of whack and out of balance when it comes to this consistency. Number one, when family activity keeps you from capital F family activity as a pattern, you've got it upside down. When lowercase family, father, mother, brother, sisters, grandparents, when lowercase family competes or keeps you away from the responsibilities of being a capital F family member of Jesus, then you've got things out of whack. You're inconsistent. Number two, and I've already alluded to this, but when decisions in your life are first and foremost what is best for my lowercase family, not what is best for the glorifying of my uppercase father, then you've got things out of whack and you're inconsistent. The consistency of true followers of Jesus Christ is identifiably they will do the will of God. What is the will of God? Go back to chapter 1 and verse 15. It is repenting and believing in the gospel. It is also, you don't have to turn there, but I will, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Paul writes, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies in a regular, ongoing way as a living sacrifice. The point of a living sacrifice is that it is perpetually a sacrifice. A dead sacrifice, it has a shelf life. It is a living sacrifice. We are characterized by this, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. What does a living sacrifice look like? Verse 2, do not be conformed to this world. Don't develop a pattern where you look just like the world and there is no difference, but instead be transformed by the renewal of your mind, washing it with the word, washing it with the gospel, so that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect or complete. Beloved, this is the consistency, and the question I want to ask you is this. Are you pulling in the same direction as the will of God? And beloved, if you are, listen. The person that's sitting next to you that is out of your age demographic. The person in your small group who annoys you. The person that talks all the time, the person that will never talk, the person who, just fill in whatever blank, all of a sudden becomes family because you're pulling in the same direction. I was talking to a friend this last week who said that he saw one of his small group members out in public and they started talking about a topic that usually men don't talk about, but it was building each other up, and it was because they're brothers in Christ, they're pulling in the same direction. They're consistently doing the will of God. Beloved, that's first of all how you can identify if you are a member of the true family. But those are the people that we spend our time with. Those are the people we place as a priority. Those are the people with whom we make disciples.